For the past 2 years, the Board of Game has been hearing more and more about what's called the land-and-shoot method of hunting wolves. In some game management units of the state, it's okay to track down a wolf by airplane and then hunt the wolf on the ground after the plane has landed. Opponents of the practice think it should be banned altogether in the state. They say it gives the hunter an unfair advantage, is abused by some hunters who harass the wolves from the air, and will hurt the wolf population in the state. Before the public comment on the various wolf management proposals gets underway, Fish and Game's Division of Wildlife Conservation offered a proposal to develop a wolf management plan in the state. Officials say instead of prolonging the confrontational win-lose discussion that the issue generates, this plan would use a three-stage effort building towards a solution over the next 2 years. First, the department would let all sides have a say in what they think the problem is. Then, they would try to develop solutions with everyone involved. The Board of Game would be asked to implement that solution by the fall of 1991. Chris Smith with the Division of Wildlife Conservation proposed the idea as a start towards some agreement on wolf management instead of argument.
We would hope to identify the long-range goals and objectives for wolf management, identify potential problems in reaching the goals and some strategies for overcoming those problems. We hope to improve understanding between groups and develop a willingness to recognize others' values as legitimate and develop a conceptual framework that provides for satisfaction of the greatest range and number of people. And much as wolves divide up the real estate in Alaska, we may find that the best way to accommodate diverse interests is to clarify and commit to a system that zones, uses, or management approaches.
And the director of the division, Lou Pamplin, says the proposal has been in the works for some time as a way to try to satisfy everyone involved, since no one is happy with the way things are.
We have strategic management policies, broad guidelines right now on wolf management. The board has policies. This effort is to review that, incorporate other ideas, and get the public involved in each step of the way to where we do build a consensus, if at all possible. And I think an investment of another couple of years in this effort could pay big dividends down the road 10, 20, 30 years ahead if we can achieve that goal. We might not achieve that goal, but we're sure going to try. And what I mean by that goal is getting some agreement on and support that cost us less money, less time and effort to try to manage and conserve wolves and their prey in Alaska. And that's the whole point.
The Board of Game got the proposal for the first time yesterday. Chairman Henry Springer was glad to have something to start with, but along with other board members, stressed the importance of public involvement in the problem resolution.
I have not seen that proposal before right now. I didn't know what the guys were up to. I can speak for myself. I think you're going to have the most serious cooperation from the board. But I see two things that need to be done, that you devise some kind of either a task force or input process where all the participant groups and interest groups feel comfortable that is an objective thing and not some scheme to railroad something. And the second thing is to find sufficient money to execute that, because it's one of those deals here. In the beginning it doesn't cost much, but as it progresses through those different stages, it's going to cost more and more because the involvement is going to be more and more.
The Division of Wildlife Conservation acknowledged in the proposal that some things which divide the issue cannot be resolved. Most of those revolve around the different value individuals place on the wolf. But they say other things can be addressed, like improving poor communication between the interest groups and the government, and changing the confrontational setting to a constructive one. The board is scheduled to consider many proposals dealing with land-and-shoot wolf hunting during its meeting, but the department is recommending that those items not be addressed until the management plan is developed, except for one which generated much of the current controversy. That's a proposal by the National Park Service to ban land-and-shoot hunting in park preserves. The Park Service currently has a ban on that practice and has put off making that ban permanent until the board considers the matter during this meeting. The Department of Fish and Game is recommending that the ban be adopted. saying that method of wolf harvest is not necessary to accomplish management objectives anyway, and is opposed by a wide spectrum of the public. The Board of Game is scheduled to meet through the 15th of the month, but wolf management is the topic for the first 4 days of the board's meeting. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. Under Phillips' proposed budget, 11 city employees would be laid off. More than 20 other city jobs would be cut when employees take early retirement and job vacancies remain empty. The budget cuts more than $1 million from the police and fire departments, and concerns about public safety are sure to be raised by council members. One of the things already being questioned in the budget is how the city's hotel-motel tax would be spent. The bed tax is expected to generate more than $1 million. Under current city policy, most of that would go to the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau. But one city council member has proposed that that be changed, with less going to the Bureau and more to fund city services. And Phillips' budget is built on the assumption that that change will get council approval on Monday. Councilmember Jerry Cleworth proposed the change and is glad to see that additional money included in the budget.
We have an impact on tourism, and we have direct expenses associated with administering the funds and in other departments. And we have never kept a penny of that, and I'm glad to see that that was included. But the council has to actually vote on that particular ordinance on Monday night before it is included.
But at least one other city council member was not happy to see the bed tax money built into the budget.
We haven't even voted on that yet. All we did was advance that. And this budget is predicated on the fact that we've already approved that. And that's sad news, because I may not vote for that.
Council member Jim Hayes says he would rather have seen the budget built without that additional $300,000. So the council could see what city services would be like if the ordinance does not pass. Cleworth says if it's not passed, it would mean another 6 or 7 jobs would have to go. Jim Hayes is also concerned about the layoff numbers he's seen. Since the budget talk began and the tax cap restrictions have been brought up, Hayes says he's heard too many different numbers.
The first word I got was that we're going to lay off 50 people. That was the first word. Within 2 or 3 days, it's down to 20 people. And now today I find that we're actually talking about 12 people that are actually going to be laid off. So he's going to have to show me why we started with 50 in the beginning.
City council members met this week with interior legislators, and they did not get much encouragement that more money might be coming from the state either. The city's top revenue source is state government assistance, but Rebecca Miller of the governor's office told them not to expect a windfall, since she expects it to be a tough budget year at the state level.
I would not be looking for any increased money out of general whatsoever, and I would be praying that I could keep my hands on the level of funding that I have had in the past.
For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
Anchorage has recalled their blood, and what we're trying to do is increase the number of donors we have on our donor calling list. It's not an emergency situation or anything like that. We are a little short on specific types, such as O negative and A negative, mainly because there aren't that many of those people out there. And until the issue is resolved in Anchorage, we would like to try and get everything we need right here in our own community.
This time it was the union, the Alaska State Employees Association, that called a halt to the negotiations, saying its deadlock with the state over wages and health benefits has gone on long enough. In a formal filing with the State Labor Relations Agency, the ASEA asked for mediation as the next step toward resolving differences that 9 months of negotiations have not. Some workers in the union can proceed from mediation to binding arbitration over a new contract, while others cannot. If mediation does not produce a new contract, they can authorize a strike, however, just as two other groups of state employees have, including workers aboard the ferry system. The ASEA coupled its request for mediation with another accusation of bad faith bargaining by the Cooper administration. The union says there is plenty of money, just not the will to fund a pay raise for state rank and file workers. As a result, says the union complaint, the administration has engaged in mere surface bargaining. That is, going through the motions of labor talks without any serious effort at reconciling differences. The state labor relations director, Bruce Cummings, denies that. He says there is simply no justification for raising salaries this year. As for mediation at this point, Cummings says that sounds like a good idea to him. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
Three, two, one. The candidates for North Pole City Council have a lot in common. They all want to see the community stay financially healthy. They want to keep the quality of life the small town offers. They oppose unification, and they think the city's 3% sales tax is a good thing, helping the community achieve some financial stability. One of those candidates is incumbent Karen Johnson. Having served 3 years now on the council, Johnson is proud of where the city is today and wants to see that continue.
I like our community. I'm proud of the fact that we don't have debt, and I'm proud of the fact that we have really good services. We have a good fire department. We have good police protection. It's a nice, clean community, and it's healthy. We don't have a lot of the problems that larger communities have, and I think that I'd like to see that kind of healthy conservative growth continue.
Also vying for a city council seat is Roland Peretti. His first time in any political campaign, Peretti stresses the quality of life in North Pole.
I'm concerned about three basic areas. Number one, protection for our homes, for our property, for our lives, with adequate fire and police protection. I'm concerned about services to meet basic needs, such as the water and sewer, safe and well-maintained roads, and I'm concerned about community support, including a healthy business climate and quality schools, parks, and a family-oriented environment.
This is the third time candidate Jill Albrecht has run for a North Pole City Council position. Albrecht says the city has worked hard to get where it is, and she wants to see that continue.
Economic development, stable tax base, those are things we've enjoyed over the past 10 years. We have to continue to maintain a stable tax base so we can continue to attract economic development.
And the fourth candidate, James Hunter, also thinks the city has come a long way. He wants to see more activities for young people in North Pole and would like to help the community continue on the right track.
I also enjoy what I see as far as the health services that are being provided for us, the fire protection, the road services. I think there's a lot of good things that's going on in North Pole. I think the city council and the mayor is to be commended for what they are doing. I am running basically because I think I would like to be a part of those services.
Election day is tomorrow in North Pole. With two council seats open, the two candidates with the most votes will win the election. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
It's really a great service for people that are burnouts. You know, they're burned out of their homes or all kinds of problems. We had one lady call up a couple months ago because her husband left. He left the state and cleaned out their bank accounts, and she had four little kids under 9 years old and really just didn't have any food for a meal for that evening. And so she was really hurting, and for stuff like that, we're really a really wonderful service. I really believe strongly in it, and this food that we get from the Cannes Food Festival is a great help all year.
Public employees tend to take the brunt of the criticism from the private sector, and a lot of it, I suspect, is simply that they don't want to pay a livable wage to people, and they want to make more money off of other people working. You know, it's something's got to be done, and we have to do it together as a community, and we're starting together as all the public employees to let the business community know that all our dollars stay here in Fairbanks and they help all of us. And if they're going to bash public employees, we're going to cut off the flow of dollars to them.
We're simply suggesting that the private sector would like to see as much responsibility go into government, and the funding and the responsibility for that funding that goes into government, that the members of chamber are having to put into their own businesses. And that's not employee bashing. We certainly respect them as members of the economy, members of our community, and at no time should it be construed that we are singling them out. They simply fall under the auspices of the government that we are trying to send a message to that we would like it streamlined.
3, 2, 1. Council members heard from more than 24 people about the bed tax money last night. Most opposed any changes, saying the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau should continue to get 70% of bed tax revenues to promote tourism. They cited the accomplishments that have been made over the years in bringing in more tourists. The bed tax was initially approved 10 years ago with the agreement that it would be used for tourism and economic development. The proposal before the council would have given only 50% of the bed tax money to promote tourism and conventions. That means the Bureau would have had about $200,000 less than it had this year. City Council member Jerry Cleworth requested the change, saying the money is needed for the city services that are also enjoyed by tourists. But most of the council members preferred to keep the agreement that was originally made when the tax was started and continue to give most of the money to the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau. The Fairbanks Industrial Development Corporation also gets 10% of the $1 million the bed tax generates. In electing to keep spending the bed tax the way it's spent now, the city council also now has to deal with another $300,000 deficit in its own budget. The 1990 budget was drafted to include that money for city services. Without it, anywhere from 6 to 8 more city jobs could be eliminated. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
The number of tourists on pilgrimages to see Mount McKinley just keeps growing. And even though there are great views of the mountain from the south side, the nearest hotels are on the other side of the Alaska Range, clustered in and around the entrance to Denali National Park. Now the state has come up with a way to siphon off some of that tourist traffic and create jobs. In a preliminary decision, Commissioner of Natural Resources Lenny Gorsuch says she's about to seek bids from companies wanting to design and build a hotel in Denali State Park on the south side of Mount McKinley. The key attraction, great views of the mountain. The complex would include between 100 and 250 rooms, a restaurant, perhaps a gift shop, but no golf courses or outdoor swimming pools.
Hiking trails and cross-country skiing and some of those things certainly would be an asset and would be allowed in the park, but nothing which is a destination resort attraction in and of itself.
Concessionaires will have to pay a minimum fee of $50,000 plus 5% of their gross income, as well as salaries and expenses for 3 park rangers. To accompany the commercial development, the state will build a visitor center with federal funds. The site for the new project is near High Lake, halfway up Kusugie Ridge on the north end of the park. In 1986, the state put out preliminary plans for this type of project further south at a place called Curry Ridge. Public opposition sunk that idea. Cliff Ames from the Alaska Center for the Environment fought hotel development on Curry Ridge, and he's now opposing this plan. He says there should be no commercial development in the park. His preferred location for a hotel is on Alaska Railroad land right outside the park boundary.
We see this as potentially being a win-win situation. That is, commercial hotel development can occur in the immediate vicinity of the park, but the park lands themselves can be protected for future generations.
Ames isn't alone in his opposition. The Citizens Advisory Board set up to advise the state also came out against commercial development within state park boundaries. Like Cliff Ames, the Susitna Valley State Park Citizen Advisory Board supports campgrounds and visitor centers in the park, but not hotels. The state will be taking public comment for a month and holding hearings in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Palmer, and the Susitna Valley. If the Commissioner of Natural Resources stands by her preliminary decision and puts the hotel out to bid, more development in the state park could follow. Commissioner Gorsuch says she's also interested in a small wilderness lodge on the south side of Denali State Park. The master plan describes a lodge accessible only by plane or helicopter in the Tokositna River area, where Sidney Lawrence painted his gleaming views of Mount McKinley. In Anchorage, I'm Bruce Melzer.
There are a couple of options on going with the bed tax. One would be area-wide, which would mean that there would be 2% on top of the 8% that the city of Fairbanks already collects. Another option would be to go non-area-wide, but then there wouldn't be enough revenues generated from the few motels, hotels, and bed and breakfasts that are outside the cities to offset the $100,000. So area-wide would generate enough revenue to eliminate the non-area-wide property tax and have a little leftover maybe to help out with some of the Alaska land operations.
On Tuesday, the Board of Game voted to open much of the interior to hunters who want to track wolves by airplane and then hunt them on foot. Yesterday, the Board of Game agreed to stop the practice in park preserves for all but subsistence hunters. For the last 2 years, the board has been battling the National Park Service on its same-day airborne hunting ban in national preserves. The federal agency says it's not considered an appropriate use of park preserve lands, but the state feels it's a matter for the Board of Game to decide. The Park Service proposed the change to the board this fall, and to the surprise of some board members, the State Department of Fish and Game recommended that the change be adopted. Deputy Director Wayne Reglin says after battling for 2 years, it won't hurt to go along with the ban.
Go ahead and close it, because it doesn't have a real biological effect on the prey or on the predators in these areas, and there's just a lot of people in the public that are opposed to this. Most people don't differentiate between parks and preserves in their mind, and to them, land and shooting in national park lands is something that they just don't like. And based on those things, we're recommending to you to close it. We're not doing it because the Park Service is threatening us or anything else.
Board of Game members believe the National Park Service will do what it wants to anyway, whether the board agrees to it or not. But Samantha Castle of Fairbanks proposed that within the ban, an exception should be made for subsistence users. Castle says at least that addition would make it clear that the board wants to protect land and shoot for subsistence use.
My intention is to have this stated in our regulation book that we have a land and shoot season available for subsistence users in the preserves. Now, the effect of this is as negligible as the problem statement. There, according to the information I have, we will probably have no more than 4 or 5 animals, if that, taken by aircraft in the preserves by anybody.
Department of Fish and Game officials say an average of 9 wolves a year were killed on preserve lands by the land and shoot method over the last 6 years. Some Board of Game members supported the ban only when the amendment to protect subsistence uses was added, even though Lou Waller with the National Park Service wasn't sure how much of a difference that wording would make.
We've not had any input that tells from anybody that tells us that subsistence users in the preserves have taken wolves by the land and shoot method. No one has told us that out of hundreds and thousands of comments that we've received. We've not seen this as a subsistence issue. It's just simply an inappropriate use on park areas.
6 of the 7 Board of Game members approved the ban on land and shoot hunting in preserves. The ban will also cover preserves in the new areas that the board just opened to land and shoot hunting. That includes much of the interior, extending all the way to the Brooks Range, land surrounding Fairbanks and extending south to Tok. Plus, the game unit south of Tok, going almost all the way to the Gulf of Alaska, was added. And land stretching from Glen Allen to Denali National Park is also now on the list of areas where land and shoot hunting is okay. The board made those changes after 3 days of public testimony where many people opposed the land and shoot hunting method. But board chairman Henry Springer says recommendations from local advisory committees get the heaviest consideration from the board, not how much public comment an issue generates.
It is not a vote-by-vote process. It is not that some 1,500 people testify one way and 1,200 the other way, that it's automatically that the 1,500 people win. If we would like, or if the lawmakers would have envisioned that process, we don't need a board. We just buy a scale. And they come in and we weigh the papers, and whichever way it goes down, that's the winning party.
The Board of Game also approved some restrictions to try to cut down on illegal land and shoot hunting. They include requiring hunters to register with the Department of Fish and Game before taking wolves. They would also be restricted to hunting in 3 game management units to limit their range. And metal tags would also have to be placed on wolves taken. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. Several community leaders who want to create a good environment for kids heard from Fred Alley yesterday. Alley runs the Covenant House in Anchorage, part of a not-for-profit nationwide shelter program for runaway kids who need a safe place to go. The Anchorage Covenant House has been in place for 1 year, and in that time, Alley says about 5% of the kids that have come in have been from Fairbanks. Fairbanks organizations want to try to do something themselves for these types of kids, and that includes considering a shelter here. Alley told them he thinks this community has the ability to come up with a program, but he suggested that to develop a plan, they should find out exactly what the needs here are and how many kids they're talking about.
Because you don't want to build a shelter in Fairbanks for 60 kids if your average daily census is going to be 5. Okay? You're probably going to want to develop a shelter program also based on what are the ages of these kids. Are we looking at kids primarily 13 through 16? Are we looking at kids 13 through 20? Where does the age break down? So I think, again, in a lot of the interviews and in discussions with social service providers here in the community, nonprofit organizations, I think is real important to try to identify that information.
Alley says once they find out what the needs of the Fairbanks community are, the next step is to talk with other social service providers, find out what they are doing currently for kids and what they are capable of doing. Then they'll know how much work lies ahead. Several Fairbanks community groups have been meeting the last several months to try to do just that. The Youth at Risk group is being coordinated by Major Charles Gillies of the Salvation Army. Gillies says Youth at Risk right now is looking at what the problem is, how big it is, and what can be done, and he believes eventually the community will do something.
It seems to me there are several areas, answers that will eventually come out of this. Someplace there will be a Covenant House, a shelter for kids who are in trouble. Someplace in town will be a youth center of some kind, a safe place where the kids can go and hang out and do a variety of things. Someplace there will be an activity for military. Right now, what do we have for them besides the bars for the young guy? And that's a real problem. They're mixing with our kids at risk, and oftentimes they're kids themselves.
Gillies says he can't make things happen himself, but hopes to pull together everything being done now in the community and build on the strengths of those programs to reach the kids who are in trouble. Carolyn Winters of Catholic Community Resources would love to see a Covenant House come to Fairbanks, but no matter what type of shelter Fairbanks can devise, Winters says something must be done.
There's a real need in terms of if you look just downtown at the kids that are at Maria's, they are at Maria's, most of them, because they don't have anywhere else to go. And that became very clear in the posters that we put up. They were saying that one of their real concerns was prostitution for shelter.
Winter says the Youth at Risk group has begun to come together to make something good happen. The issue is not just one that impacts teenagers. Fairbanks is also a pilot area for a program called Communities for Child Safety. Its goal is to create injury-free communities. Teresa Usabelli says a major concern of her group is the national statistic that for people younger than 20, injuries have replaced illnesses as the leading cause of death. Usabelli says statistics haven't been compiled yet for Fairbanks, but she wants to get that information and thinks the community can help.
Most of the people in the communities do know what's happening with their kids. And so that's why it's so important to bring the community people together and ask them, what do you think are the problems, and get them to start working on them. Changing environments. Say, in Fairbanks, our cold weather is extremely cold. Maybe the people here know that kids are outside without protective clothing. So we could start a national campaign in the city to make sure children are clothed for the weather.
And Usabelli believes Fairbanks will reflect the nationwide trend of injuries killing more kids than illness. She thinks her group's efforts are directly tied to what the Youth at Risk group is working toward, safe kids. The community groups have come to the decision that they need to take an active role in creating a safer Fairbanks. The Salvation Army's Major Gillies says that will mean bringing at-risk kids closer to the support system that's here now, as well as building a better system to meet the needs of at-risk kids. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. 1. East Germans are celebrating the freedom to come and go as they please, and there's talk of reunification of Germany. Alaska Senator Ted Stevens expressed some excitement about the changes there, and some caution, too.
There's still some great risks for us, because that's a tremendous change to come about. And it's a matter of time, I think, until some of the old guard decide that maybe things have gone too far. We run some real risks that if we don't be real careful, we could see a reversion as we've seen in China and in the Eastern European area. That would be disastrous for the world, really.
But Stephen says Washington is trying to encourage the restoration of freedoms and hold out a welcoming hand. He says there's also the job of trying to solve the problems in those countries which have led people to want to leave their homeland. Stevens also thinks President Bush is handling the situation well because of the risks that are still out there.
If we're not careful, we could kindle a kind of revolution that might destabilize the whole movement. This is not a violent revolution. This is a revolution brought about by the collective just resentment of the people. And it's not an armed revolution. It's not got any military kind of impact in any of these countries. There's not been a bombing of tanks and things like we saw in Hungary or the revolts in Czechoslovakia. Those are not going on, and we would not want to stimulate that kind of a reaction. Protest and rejection of leaders is the best way to bring about change in this climate that exists in Europe right now. So I think the president's going at it just right.
The changes in Europe and the Soviet Union could also lead to changes in our government's defense strategies. A House Senate Conference Committee has just worked out the details of the Defense Appropriations Bill. Stephen says included in it is money to finish the deployment of the Light Infantry Division here so that the last battalion can be put in place at Fort Wainwright. Others in Congress have talked about future cuts in the Defense Department budget because of the government changes worldwide. Stephen says he thinks the base here should not be threatened by any cuts.
We're in a very difficult period right now. Clearly, the changes going on in the world and the changes in financing defense are putting stress upon deployments of military forces all over the world as far as United States military forces are concerned. But I believe that this deployment of the Light Division is secure here. It is the largest Army base that we have. It is a Light Division. It is a division that should the Army start reducing forces, they'd reduce the heavy ones first, because in the event of any minor problems throughout the world, short of a real war, there would be a necessity to have a light division.
Stephen says he doesn't expect sharp cuts in the Defense Department's budget in the coming year or a radical reduction in troop strength. He still sees risks for the free world. Congress is winding down action for the year. Stephen says he expects the president to sign the defense bill before the week is over. But agreements on oil spill response legislation and the Tongass will have to wait until next year. Stevens was encouraged by the oil spill liability bill that passed in the House last week.
We've had a real argument with the House representatives, those in the Senate, over a period of years, because we believe that states do have the right to enact laws that deal with pollution of water within their borders. The House has taken a position that since it's a matter of interstate commerce, that the federal government should preempt the states from enacting comprehensive oil spill liability laws. For the first time, the House agrees with the Senate We're closer together now than we've been in a period of about 8 years, and I think we should be able to work out a very good bill. It will not be, however, until after the first of the year, because we've only got about 9 days left.
Stephen says the differences between the House and the Senate versions of the oil spill legislation are that the House wants double bottom and double hull tankers, and the Senate wants the Coast Guard to study that question further. And also, the Senate-approved legislation emphasizes prevention, while the House focuses on cleanup. But he believes the differences can be worked out and an oil spill liability bill ready by early next year. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. The lodge in Denali State Park would be part of a larger visitor complex on the south side of the Alaska Range. A visitor center and recreational areas would also be developed in the 8,500-acre northeast corner of the state park property. David Stevens with the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation says the spot offers a good view of Mount McKinley, and there is already highway and rail access. The 250-room lodge would be awarded by state contract. The firm that offers the best plan for the lodge would pay to study the area, design, construct, and operate the lodge. The state expects to offer a 35-year contract to the developer. In return, the state would take at least $50,000 a year, enough money to pay 3 park ranger salaries, and 5% of gross receipts from the lodge. Only 7 people testified at the Fairbanks public hearing. One of them read a resolution from the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce opposing the lodge. It charged that the state is not considering the impact on the tourist businesses on the north side of the park and criticized the monopoly that would be given to that one development, while small businesses wouldn't be able to compete. The chamber and some others at the hearing said private development in Kantishna would be a better route to take. The state feels the lodge would help the increasing tourist industry in Alaska, and Janet Halverson with the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau agrees with that goal.
They're coming. We want to see more of them come. We have a big land. We have a wonderful place to show off. And we do need to have some more development. And I tend to feel like that this would be somewhat of a draw to Fairbanks. I think it's like Airport Road with all the fast food places. When you get one, more will come, and we will see development north of the range.
However, Bob Thomas is concerned that the development south of the Alaska Range will hurt tourist prospects in Fairbanks.
I object to the state spending money to develop a site that may discourage tourists from coming on to Fairbanks. Once again, I don't know if that will happen, but I don't think the report has addressed that.
Only about 20 people attended last night's public hearing. David Stevens says that he heard some things he expected to.
This issue of regional competition between Anchorage and Fairbanks, and where the tourists enter the Denali region, where they stay, where they spend their money. In fact, the site that we've located is almost exactly midway between Anchorage and Fairbanks. Although it is south of the Alaska Range, the highway miles are pretty much the same. And it's our view that there is such a shortage of visitor facilities and tourism facilities right now that there isn't much danger that anything on the south side is going to siphon away business from the north side. It is that it would add to the base of facilities and, in fact, attract new people, people who wouldn't ordinarily have come.
The state is holding 3 more hearings this week. Stevens expects more of a turnout Thursday night in Anchorage and Wednesday in Talkeetna, since it's closest to the proposed lodge site. Stevens says before making a recommendation to the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner, public comments made at the hearings and in writing will be considered. Beyond the yes and no answers to whether the lodge should be built, Stevens says they'll look at why people are saying what they are and see if any revisions should be made. Concerns should include one that was raised last night, that the area may become too commercialized. DNR Commissioner Lenny Gorsuch is expected to make a decision next month on whether or not to go ahead with the lodge on state park land. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. An 8-member panel made up of school district representatives, local employers, and a recent graduate spent a lot of time talking about vocational education last night. They agree that vocational education has an image problem, but it's something that many high school students could benefit from. Wendy Bonacore graduated from the alternative school in 1988 and now works for a travel agency in Fairbanks. Bonacore says she has been able to apply a lot of what she learned on the job and believes she was prepared for the working world. But she enrolled in the tourism program at the Hutchison Career Center, a program she says she wouldn't even have known about if she hadn't received a letter about it in the mail. She blames that on a lack of counseling at the high school level.
When I went through high school, it just wasn't there. Hutchison just never even came up, really. It was never even mentioned, and it's just a whole other school. I mean, it's a whole other world of opportunity over there, really, and I just feel like the counseling and guidance is just really poor at this point.
Part of the problem, though, is the counselors have to work with more students than they can in a given day. The huge job they have before them also lends support to some other ideas that were raised by the panel last night, restructuring the school so they can do a better job for all the students. One of the things they want to do, though, is improve the image of vocational education. Nina Rawson of the State Job Service says 40% of high school graduates go straight to work and are not college-bound. That means they need to be ready to handle a job. But many of them aren't, and not just because they haven't learned the basics in school. Local employer Dick Audette hires as many as 60 new employees a year at Fred Meyer, and half of them are 18 to 20 years old. But Audette says what he's looking for in an employee is not just how much they know about the basics they learned in school, but also things like honesty, punctuality, work ethic, and a good attitude.
I'm really high on the youth of today. I think there's some real wonderful kids out there, but I think a lot of them are lacking maturity needed at the level when they come out to work. They suddenly find themselves on their own. High school's been fun, and now they're out trying to make a living, and they suddenly come to grips with the reality of the real world. And it's almost like it's a holdover from, well, class doesn't start for 5 minutes, so I can sit out here and talk to my friends, and as long as I'm going in the door at 9, I'm in time for class. But in the workplace, you must be in your workplace and ready to go to work, not driving in the parking lot. You're tardy, and so it's a very important thing to realize, punctuality and dependability.
Local employers on the panel say they want employees who want more than just a job. They want to hire kids who have goals toward a career and have the self-discipline to pursue them. And they also know that much of that isn't just taught at school, but starts at home. There are jobs which are hard to fill here in Fairbanks. Nina Rawson of the Job Service says bank tellers, computer repair, and daycare workers are all entry-level jobs that are available to high school graduates here.
And if they're entry-level and they have the enthusiasm and they've got the basic skills and they have the typing skills or the computer or the word processing, they've got a job.
The principal of the Hutchison Career Center, Chuck Elliott, says part of the problem is we've become a user nation rather than a producer nation. Many vocational education programs are designed to prepare students for specific jobs, but there's still the problem of image to overcome. Vocational education has a stigma of being for students who aren't college-bound, and Elliott says the perception is that if you don't go to college, you're worth less. Some suggested that perhaps something as simple as a name change could improve the image of vocational education. But the issue of restructuring local schools also comes back into play. Educator Susan Stitham says really all education should be vocational. Core things should be integrated early in the educational program, with more time spent in the final years of school working on preparing for the job world or for college. Many high school level courses incorporate practical things necessary for life after high school, and the goal is to bring vocational education as close to real life as it can be. But even if high school graduates have all the technical skills needed to succeed, attitudes and values are also learned outside the classroom. Panel members could address many of the problems, but part of the solutions are beyond the reach of the schools. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ian Thornton.
also is to help people that want to quit smoking, that just need a little help. And who's better than ex-smokers? They went through it all, and what we're asking people, just to quit for 24 hours, and maybe they'll quit forever. And lung cancer is our number one killer for men and women, and we just feel like we'll save a few lives.
Governor Cooper says the triple impact of welfare reform, additions to the Medicaid program, and the withdrawal of federal money used to educate the children of military personnel in the state means an automatic boost in the state budget next year. He's still sorting out all the reasons for this, but Cooper says it appears the president's campaign pledge of no new taxes is sending more expenses to state governments, but without the revenues to pay for them. Cooper told Alaska Mayor's meeting here that this makes his job and theirs all that much harder.
Beginning in the next fiscal year, we've got to pay $100 million extra even before we start looking at our own budget. That's the reality of the situation. It is not likely to change anytime in the immediate future. It is not likely to change, quite the contrary.
The $100 million budget increase could be just part of the actual budget boost. State agencies still must check in with their request to the governor, and they're likely to add to the total, all at a time when oil production from Prudhoe Bay is heading downward. This, Cooper says, means either tax increases, and he suggested again that the state return to personal income taxes at some point, or the elimination of some services.
Put it another way, it means if we're going to reduce the budget at a state level, then people are going to have to cut programs and go straight to the various beneficiaries and vested interests who are enjoying the benefits and say, we're not going to do that anymore. We're not going to give you this money. We're not going to pay for your benefits anymore and take the heat.
But the legislature and the governor have been reluctant to amputate state services outright, and Cooper says if tax increases are needed and if they won't come from Washington or Juneau, then local governments will have to take up the issue. Higher property taxes or sales taxes, the kinds of increases that local governments have been able to avoid over the last decade through increased revenue sharing from the state.
But you can see the way the trends are running. It means that you're going to have to pay a lot more attention to local politics than you have to state politics, and in many ways that's a good trend. That's a good trend because what it will lead to, frankly, is a lot of diversity around the state.
And that diversity is certainly represented here this week. Alaska mayors, anticipating the governor's remarks, have drafted resolutions to the legislature asking for greater flexibility in taxing matters. Those and a call for more revenue sharing from the state will be taken up on Friday. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
Just explain to me exactly what's going to be going on here Saturday.
On Saturday, the Commission on the Future of the Permanent Fund will be holding a public hearing at the Nolwenn Library starting at 10 a.m. and running till 5 p.m., taking public testimony from people of Alaska who are the shareholders of the Permanent Fund Corporation, asking the question, what do you think we should do with our Permanent Fund account?
Okay, why are you doing this?
The legislature in 1989 asked that a commission be formed to look into this question about the permanent fund because we're running into a problem with the fund in that we don't have enough money to pay dividends and also fully inflation-proof the fund in the future. So we're asking Alaskans what do they think we should be doing, inflation-proofing, paying dividends. Right now the governor has a proposal to create an educational endowment. We're also asking people to testify on that and any other proposal they may have for use of the funds, such as small business development. We've heard from people in that regard, or other types of resource development, and just how important the fund is to them. That's what we're hearing from people.
Do you mean things to do with the fund other than pay dividends or in addition to paying dividends and inflation proofing? It doesn't sound like there's enough to do all that.
There isn't enough to do all that. The question, some people have been proposing that the actual corpus of the fund, which is the money in the bank, be used to stimulate Alaskan economies, to use that as loans for small businesses, for example. The problem with that is that the fund is mandated by statute only to invest money in non-high-risk ventures, and a lot of Alaskan ventures are high-risk. So maybe we want to take a little bit higher risk and invest in Alaska. That may be a proposal, or somebody may have a proposal for that idea. The commission is not going to make any determinations at this point. All we are doing is asking that the public come forward and tell the commission what they think and to give public testimony. Our job is to take public testimony, not to tell the public what we think, but rather for the public to tell us what they think.
How long has the commission been doing this, and what kinds of things have you been hearing at the other places that you've gone?
The commission has been in existence for about 6 months. We were mandated by statute to hold public hearings in all judicial districts in the state. This is our second time around for this particular judicial district. We did Bethel earlier in the year, last month. We've been to Barrow, Nome, Ketchikan, Juneau, Kenai, Fairbanks, Anchorage. We try to hit as many of the rural communities as we can, because the dividend, of course, is very important to people on subsistence earning lifestyles, because it may be their only source of income for the year. And also in the urban sectors of our state, the dividend check is very important to stimulating the economy. When that check comes out and people go out and spend it on a new set of snow tires or a new wood stove or whatever it is they may be buying with their check, it stimulates the small businesses and gets the economy moving when at a time when it's necessary to do that, right after and during the winter months.
So when you were in Fairbanks before, did a lot of people come and tell you a lot of things that were different than other parts of the state were telling you?
Actually, when we held our commission meeting in Bethel, we teleconference in a lot of the other communities within that judicial district. We did teleconference in Fairbanks at that time, and we had an extensive amount of testimony from people in Fairbanks, and we're hoping that even more people show up, since we're here in person at the Noel Wien Library this Saturday, to take the public testimony about proposals with the permanent fund, either the earnings of the fund or investment strategies. Any idea you may have about the permanent fund, now is your chance to come and do it live and in person at the Noel Wien Library. The Commission on the Future of the Permanent Fund will be holding a public hearing, taking testimony and asking people to testify about what they think the permanent fund should be doing with the money in the bank, with the earnings from that money, or with any other type of idea that you may have. Please come and attend and give your testimony.
And this one won't be teleconference, the one here.
Yes, it will be.
Mm-hmm. Do all over the state like the others?
This is not a statewide. This is right now we're still in our judicial districts. We'll be teleconferencing to Bethel, Big Delta, Glen Allen, and we teleconference through Anchorage, although we don't take much testimony from there. We do allow testimony from all the other teleconference communities within the judicial district. We really try to focus on this judicial district, which is the Fairbanks-Bethel region, and then we have one more scheduled two more scheduled for statewide. One will be held in Anchorage and one will be held in Juneau. December 9th is our last commission meeting before we start working on our report for the legislature, which is due February 1 of next year, 1990.
And that will recommend to them different things?
The report that we're preparing, the Commission on the Future of the Permanent Fund is preparing for the legislature, will dictate the testimony of the people that have come to these hearings or have filled out the questionnaire that we've been distributing statewide. We are going to try to reflect what the people of Alaska think we should be doing with the fund, and that's why we're giving this forum to people on Saturday to come and speak about the permanent fund and to give your ideas across in person, live, or if you don't feel comfortable with public speaking, you can still come and attend and listen, and then we have a questionnaire that you can fill out and give your written opinions. It's a very simple questionnaire. It takes about 5 minutes to fill out. And you can give your written opinions about what the permanent fund should be doing in the long-term economic future of the state. These are very important questions, and everyone has a stake in it, and everyone has an ownership responsibility in the permanent fund because we all get dividends. We're all shareholders in the permanent fund. So we want to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to give their opinion, and that's what this hearing is for on Saturday. and the statewide hearing on December 25th. On November 25th and on December 9th, you can once again testify teleconferencely. The one on Saturday will be live at the Noel Wien Library starting at 10 o'clock, and we'd really encourage everyone to come out and give their public opinion.
Been here very long, but since the permanent fund is like $10 billion, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about how to invest that you want ideas on how to invest $10 billion from the public.
Actually, the commission is more interested in what we do with the earnings from the $10 billion. The $10 billion account is being adequately managed by the Board of Trustees. Now, if you don't think it's being adequately managed, please come and let us know specifically where you think there are problems. But our mandate is to look at the earnings of the fund, which is the money that from the bank account, actually, and how we're going to distribute that money. Right now, we do three things with it. We pay dividends, which takes about 50%. We reinvest it back into the fund to offset inflation, which takes about 40%. And then we have 10% left over to use for general government purposes. To this point, that 10% has been also reinvested in the fund by reappropriation of the legislature. The problem in the future is that there will not be enough money in the earnings from the bank account to pay dividends and also inflation proof. So one of the questions we're asking people is, if you had to choose between getting a dividend check for the full amount or ensuring that the permanent fund has adequate funds to offset inflation so that the actual value of the fund when your kids get a dividend will be equal to the amount that you're getting today, what would you rather us do with the money? That's one of the important questions we're asking Alaskans. So in short, the commission is looking at what to do with the earnings of the fund more than necessarily the corpus or the actual investment of the corporation.
When you said that 10% goes back in, the legislature reappropriated that, does that go into then inflation proof so that we're actually inflation proofing 50%?
We actually technically know, because technically inflation proofing is done on an index based on the national inflation rate, which varies from year to year, month to month, actually. The last 3 or 4 years it's been at 3% and 4%, so it hasn't cost us a lot of money to inflation proof the $10 billion account. But if inflation goes to 11% like it was in the early 80s, 11 and 12 and 18% in that time period, then it's going to take a lot of money to inflation proof the fund, and probably more money. And the problem is that it's going to take more money than the fund earns to inflation proof it and also pay the statutorily set amount of dividends. So we're asking people, what do you want us to do? Do you want us to keep giving you a dividend check at the statutory amount and not fully inflation proof the fund, or should we fully inflation proof it to make sure that it's adequately protected against the loss in the value of the dollar?
But then wouldn't dividends go down?
Yes, that would affect the dividend distribution amount. Mm-hmm. The dividend would go down, but the money is not being spent by state governments, being reinvested into the account. So that's an argument against, that's argument for the inflation proofing, is that we're putting the money back into the bank account so that it will be there when our kids want to get a dividend check 15, 20, 30 years from now. We want to make sure that the fund is equal to the actual dollars, the $89 in the year 2005 or 2010. We want to make sure that the fund has not lost its value over time, which is what inflation does.
What are you hearing? I mean, since you've been doing this for a while, are you getting the impression from people? I mean, I would think, just from being in Fairbanks a short time, that there are a lot of people here that are more concerned about their dividends than anything else. I mean, is that what the consensus is so far?
It's natural for people to be concerned about the dividend program because it is money in their pocket. And, well, it should be, because the money belongs, and the corporation, the Permanent Fund Corporation, is a product of the resources of the state of Alaska, which belong to everyone. So the dividend check is a way for the person, the individual Alaskan, to make a decision about how they want to spend their natural resource money, rather than leaving it to the legislature to decide how to spend that money. That was the idea behind the dividend check. Give the money to the individual Alaskans and let them decide how they want to spend the money, rather than building new roads and schools and other programs. The problem that we're seeing now is that we're not having the amount of oil dollars because of the decrease in the amount of the value of oil that's going through the pipeline, and the decrease in the actual amount of oil going through the pipeline. The amount of money that state government needs to function is decreasing. So a lot of legislators, in fact, 81 bills last session were introduced to affect in one way or another the permanent fund. So what the commission is doing is going out and finding out what the shareholders, the Alaskans, the people who own the fund, think we should be doing with it, so that we can tell the legislature this is what Alaskans think, whether it be keep the dividend check, whether it be to inflation proof, whether it be to create an educational endowment. Whatever idea you have to use the money for, you should come on Saturday to the Noelween Library and tell the commission what you think.
Well, boy, you just get a crowd there, won't you?
I hope so.
Now, who's on the commission? This commission again?
Yes, it's a legislatively created commission, and 1989 legislature created it. The persons appointed to the commission, the commissioners include Lance Parrish, who's a attorney here in Fairbanks, from he's a lifelong Alaskan. Steve Frank, who's a senator from Fairbanks. Many people will be familiar with those two. Also, the chairman of the commission is Red Boucher, who is the former lieutenant governor and also former mayor of Fairbanks. He will be there in person at the Noelween Library on Saturday. Also, Senator Jan Fakes is a commissioner. David Van Amberg from Anchorage. Susan Burke, who's a private citizen and attorney from Juneau. And then, in addition to those persons, Hugh Malone, who's the commissioner of revenue, is one of the commissioners and will be there Saturday. And also John Kelsey, who's the chairman of the Permanent Fund Corporation, who makes the decisions about investing the fund, will also be there. So these are some very important players in the whole political process involving the Permanent Fund, and these commissioners are people who are going to make decisions, and they really want to know what you think, what the Alaskans, the shareholders, think about the Permanent Fund and how we should be spending the money and how we should be investing it, and any other ideas that you may have. And they will not know unless you come on Saturday and tell them in person or fill out the questionnaire, which will be available at the Noelween Library.
But the legislature isn't bound by the recommendations that will come out of this, right? I mean, they'll just make a recommendation, but the legislature will do whatever they want, right? But this will let them know what the public thinks anyway.
This is an opportunity for the public to get their verbatim testimony to the legislator, because we are going to take the testimony that's given and distribute it to the legislature in addition to the recommendations of the commission based on the testimony that's given. So the legislators will have the opportunity to read through the testimony and say, in my district, Sam Smith said that the dividend program was critically important to his family and their lifestyle because they needed it to buy a new rifle or a new outboard motor or new hip boots or whatever it is that they had to buy for that year. They needed the dividend check. And those actual people who come and testify are going to become known to the legislators through the report in addition to the recommendations that are made. Now, it is true that the recommendations are not binding on the legislature, the recommendations made by the commission, but they do carry a lot of weight, particularly if people of interest within the community who have a strong public opinion come forward and make their opinions known at the commission hearing.
About how many people would you say have testified so far?
We have taken testimony. This will be our eighth public hearing, and my guess would be about 200 people statewide have actually testified. Now, the number of people that have filled out questionnaires is ranging into the 1,000 range. We're trying to shoot for 5,000 people who actually fill out the questionnaire, and hopefully in 250 to 300 actual live testimony people. Now, Fairbanks is going to be, I think, our biggest turnout. We've reserved a room at the Noelween Library that will accommodate a large group of people, and we're hoping that we can fill that room up and have them pouring out the doors with people who have strong public opinion about the permanent fund, about the dividend program, about inflation proofing, and any other idea that may come forward at this hearing. We're going to stay past the 5 o'clock cutoff date if people want to testify. There's no limit to how long you can testify, and that we're going to stay late if we have to get as many people as we can on the record.
Why do you think you'll have more of a turnout here, because of the area that it covers?
Fairbanks has traditionally been, is the heart of Alaska, and has traditionally been strong in public opinion about issues in and around that affect the state. And the main thing that we want to make sure is that people hear about the opportunity to testify at the hearing, and that they, it's very casual, it's very, it's non-confrontational, so that people can feel free to just come and listen or talk or whatever they want to do. And I think that Fairbanks is going to be our best hearing that we've had to date, particularly in considering the fact that Senator Frank is from this area, who's one of the commissioners, Lance Parrish is one of the commissioners and also lives in the area, and Red Boucher is the former mayor of Fairbanks, is the chairman of the commission, and they have been promoting the hearing quite extensively for the last 3 or 4 weeks.
And it's called again the Commission on the Future of the Permanent Fund? That's
yes, the title is the Commission on the Future of the Permanent Fund, and it's meeting Saturday, December 18th, that's this Saturday, starts at 10 a.m., and it's at the Noel Wien Library Conference Room.
And your title?
My name is Fate Putman, and I'm the director of the Commission on the Future of the Permanent Fund.
And it's Putman?
Yes, P-U-T-M-A-N.
I put them down.
So. It's okay. It happens all the time.
Okay. Thanks.
And I'm a local kid.
3, 2, 1. The ice that's buried deep within glaciers offers a history lesson on the Earth's environment. Scientists can take a core of glacier ice and tell you what the climate was like during a given period of time. In fact, they hope the information that's buried deep within some of the Earth's coldest spots will be able to tell something about the Earth's future. By measuring the conductivity of the compressed ice, scientists can read the seasons. Things like the Chernobyl nuclear accident are encapsulated in the climatic history of an ice core. John Kelly, director of the Polar Ice Coring Office here, says by tracking Chernobyl signals in the ice, you can find out how far its effects traveled and even the year it happened by its depth in the ice core. Kelly says with today's technology, scientists can use the core to determine what the climate was like during many major events.
The great volcanic events that have occurred, all preserved in the ice. We can find dry periods and periods of drought when we look at the isotopic composition of the ice. So the technology is now available to go back and say, what was the climate like during the first Christmas? What was it like during the Little Ice Age? What was the climate like when the pyramids were being built? And we can tell a lot about the history.
Next summer, scientists plan to drill into the Greenland ice cap and come out with 200,000 years worth of the Earth's climatic history. The trick to the whole effort is to bring out the core of the ice without altering it in any way. The slightest mistake means you get ice chips instead of a solid core. Last summer, PICO tested its carefully designed drill in the ice cap, drilling more than 10,000 feet. The drill passed the test, needing only minor modifications. When drilling into the ice cap deep through the bedrock, a fluid must be used to minimize the vibrations the drill will have on the ice. Kelly says it took a while, but they finally came up with butyl acetate as an environmentally safe compound with the same density as the surrounding ice. Kelly says the drill is making it possible to get through the bedrock of the ice cap, and scientists aren't likely to stop when they get that far.
Once we get through the Greenland ice cap to bedrock, nobody is going to want to stop. I can think of no engineer or scientist who would want to say that, because all that weight of ice has bowed down the Greenland ice cap, and everybody is going to want to keep on going. And so we are already starting to develop the drilling technology that once we get to the bottom, we'll be able to satisfy that curiosity and national need, international need, in fact, to keep on going through the rock.
Kelly says the National Science Foundation project is not just exciting because of what it will tell us about the past. With a lot of talk about global warming, the greenhouse effect is an unproven theory at this point. But Kelly says by reading past history through the ice core, scientists may be able to determine where we are headed. Kelly says if there is global warming, it will have affected the ice. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Now, Fairbanks is going to be, I think, our biggest turnout. We've reserved a room at the Noel Wien Library that will accommodate a large group of people. And we're hoping that we can fill that room up and have them pouring out the doors with people who have strong public opinion about the permanent fund, about the dividend program, about inflation proofing, and any other idea that may come forward at this hearing. We're going to stay past the 5 o'clock cutoff date if people want to testify. There's no limit to how long you can testify, and that we're going to stay late if we have to get as many people as we can on the record.
3, 2, 1. About 20 residents who live just outside North Pole city limits requested the annexation because they want city services. The city of North Pole would grow from nearly 4 square miles to more than 6 by annexing the land in areas along its current boundaries. The population would also increase to more than 2,000. About 400 people would become city residents if the annexation of 12 Mile Village and the Badger Road area were approved. Services and property taxes didn't seem to be the main concerns of people who didn't want the annexation, though. Most of them said if they had wanted city services, they would have moved into the city to begin with. Opponents at Saturday's hearing were led by business owner Jeanette James.
I think it's premature to be bringing us into the city at this time. I think that eventually we will probably be part of the city when the city is ready to give us the kind of services that a city should be able to do, such as water and sewer, and that's a long ways down the road at the way they're going. So I think it's premature.
Many residents who testified questioned whether better service would actually be provided in the city limits, even if that service was needed. In all, 16 people spoke out against the annexation, 2 supported it, and letters were read from 20 more people who also supported the annexation. The local boundary commission could have sent a recommendation to annex to the state legislature, but they want all the residents to have a say in the matter, so they agreed to put it to a vote. Registered voters in the areas will be able to approve or vote down the annexation, and the areas will be separated in the vote, so that if the majority of voters in one area want to be annexed, they could be. About 200 people live in each of the affected locations. North Pole Mayor Carlita Lewis defended the annexation before the commission, but wasn't surprised by the decision.
I guess I feel, you know, how many people testified, 16, 18 against, and probably the same amount for. I'm not sure that I think that's a majority. I mean, what are they looking at, 400 people? So, I mean, you know, how do you make a decision? And, you know, they say the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and I think in this case that's what happened. So, you know, that's the way it is.
The local boundary commission did agree to recommend that the 2 other areas proposed for annexation be approved. Both those areas are much smaller and less controversial. That land includes the right-of-way along the Richardson Highway and about 6 acres just south of the Petrostar refinery. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
I think there are numerous surgical procedures that are not available and are not funded by the state of Alaska or any other state of the federal government. In fact, do people have a right to those procedures as well? I think there's a consistency argument there. If you're going to defend something as this totally private thing under a constitutional provision, it's very difficult to come back and say that then that should be paid for by the state of Alaska.
3, 2, 1. 2 proposals were given to the Assembly. 1 calls for renovating Main School. The other would place a new administration building where the University Park School now stands. The University Park project has been recommended as the one which should be chosen. The Assembly needs a voter-approved bond issue by the end of the year in order to be eligible for the state to pay most of the cost. Last night's special meeting was called specifically to consider the bond referendum, just in time to go before the voters in 2 weeks. But some Assembly members are concerned about putting the building on land the borough doesn't own. The borough leases the property from the University of Alaska. The lease expires in 30 years, and the university has indicated that it won't be extending it. Assembly member Bonnie Williams says that until the lease question is resolved, the Assembly should hold off on making the site for the administration offices specific, since University Park may not be the best site.
We don't own the land at U Park. They're not going to renew the lease. We would be throwing the money away after 30 years. The price is almost the same on Main. Maine is downtown, and closing Old Main would be rather devastating to the downtown area. The dollar price difference between the two is very small. Because it's so small, and because of the other factors, I think it would be of greater value long-term for the community to select Old Main.
The Assembly couldn't decide on a proposal last night, but members do want to get a bond question on the ballot. So even though the Assembly had pressed the issue just as late as it could because members originally wanted a site-specific proposal, seven Assembly members voted last night to make the ballot question generic, asking for the $8 million in bonds without specifically identifying which structure the bonds would be used to build or renovate. So in 2 weeks, voters will have two bond issues to decide, a $25 million referendum for the other school building improvements and a new elementary school, and $8 million for administrative office space. If that bond issue is approved, the Assembly will then decide whether to renovate Old Main or put up a new building for $8 million. But they could also turn down both proposals and find another alternative or start all over again. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
99% of the people in the area have voiced their opposition to putting a jail within their community. You can call it a halfway house. You can call it anything you like. It is a jail.
My problem is changing the rules after I'm already in. I did what was asked of me. I made a considerable investment in time and money, and have committed myself to a lengthy lease that I'm obligated to pay. And it's changing the rules after I got in, and that's what I object to.
The information that I have been presented to by Mr. Weimer this evening does not allow me to give you a probability estimate as to more likely than not, less likely than not, even money debt. I'm just saying that based on the limited information before me, yeah, there is a possibility he could establish that he's got a grandfathered use.
A retail in Anchorage is doing real well. It's not doing as well in Fairbanks, but we do think that there's probably some oil cleanup money circulating in the Fairbanks economy, too. So retail trade, even though it's down over the month, it is up from a year ago, and we do think that the Christmas season may be starting a little early with those, between the permanent fund checks and the cleanup money that's circulating in the economy.
3, 2, 1. The day after Thanksgiving is when the Christmas shopping season traditionally kicks off. The manager of the Fairbanks Nordstrom store, Marion Lundquist, says all indications are that business will be booming.
Traditionally, the day after Thanksgiving is always a retailer's dream as far as having lots of traffic, and I really don't see us not having that this year. I think it should be really good. I've noticed people are definitely out getting ideas for the holiday, so I would imagine it'll be very, very busy.
But shoppers may just be testing the waters as they head to stores this week. Fred Meyer, store manager, says the busiest shopping day will actually be in the middle of December.
I expect the 16th of December to be the busiest day because it's much closer to Christmas, and with the local payrolls in town, that would be the target that I figure is the busiest day of the year.
Fred Meyer's Dick Audette says shoppers are looking for traditional Christmas items, but he expects novelty gifts to sell well, too.
We do have some new things this year that could add to sales, such as novelty items, dancing Christmas trees that dance to music, or voice activated wreaths that speak to you as you walk up to the door and sing you a Christmas carol, again activated by voice or noise or movement. A lot of new items to the market this year.
Audette expects snowboards to sell pretty well this season, since snowboarding is becoming more popular with kids. The Sears retail store in town is approaching its first anniversary. Even though many things still are available only through the catalog, manager Rusty Buss says business has been better than expected, and some items are really selling well.
Currently, snow throwers and tractors.
are selling like mad.
And another local retailer may not be open to everyone, but it is doing pretty good business in Fairbanks this year. Nicholas Hedrick manages the Post Exchange at Fort Wainwright. The PX moved to a more modern location in May, and Hedrick says business has been up more than 50% this year. And Christmas shopping hasn't even moved into full swing.
Sales here have been real sluggish because most of the troops, not most, but a lot of the troops have been on maneuvers at Fort Greeley. And they will start returning this week with Thanksgiving. Friday, we expect the largest day of the year. I could see us doing approximately 120,000.
Generally, retailers expect the Christmas season should be good to them. Most believe the economy is on the upswing. This is the last year local shoppers will have a Nordstrom store in the area, but manager Marion Lundquist says she doesn't expect that to hurt business. She actually expects an influx of customers before the January closing.
Perhaps in some respects, some people may feel that they don't wish to shop here because of feeling disappointed that Nordstrom has chosen to leave. On the other hand, other people feel that this is their chance and they want to be prepared and get the items that they need before it's too late.
And if you're wondering just what is selling this year, just about anything. Appliances, clothes, toys, and traditional gift items are expected to be the main things on Christmas lists, and retailers hope they have to keep stocking those shelves. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. It's been 4 years since the school district surveyed the community about local schools. In 1985, more than 60% of the borough residents surveyed gave Fairbanks Public Schools an A or a B. The school board wants to know how attitudes and opinions about the school district may have changed since then. About 400 randomly selected borough residents will be asked to take part in the survey. That should allow for about a 3% margin of error. Calls will be placed later this week to the people selected. Interviewers have nearly 60 questions they'll be asking during a personal visit with the respondents. Questions will deal mostly with programs in the schools. The district's Director of Program Planning and Evaluation, Nick Stayrook, says they'll be asking about a broad range of things.
What they think is particularly good or particularly bad about the schools. We ask them to look at the various elementary programs we have and determine how important they are. Similarly, we ask them questions about full-day kindergarten. Do they think that's something that we should be doing in our school district? Should we have after-school child care programs or before-school child care programs in our schools? How do the people feel about that? At the secondary level, we ask similar questions about the secondary curriculum. For example, it should be should we be concentrating in reading, math, science, social studies, etc.? And how important are things like, having student activities in the schools, band and orchestra there, yearbook publications, foreign language instruction, those kinds of things. And we'd like to get people's opinions regarding that. There's questions about financing the schools. Would anybody in the community give us some suggestions as to how we're going to finance education in the future based on the fact that we may be getting less revenue from our traditional sources like oil revenue and things?
A few questions from the latest Gallup poll have been added to the survey. Two of them deal with parental choice, where parents could choose which public school their children would attend regardless of where they live. Stayrook says some questions will let the district see how it compares to other schools throughout the country. The first question on the survey asks for a grade of the school district, whether it should get an A, B, C, D, or F. But Stayrook says that the grade really won't be the most important thing that they hope to get from the survey.
As far as our planning purposes and things are concerned, that question on A, B, C, D, F for the school district is probably one of the least important questions for us. What's it going to tell us? How are we going to help to plan what we're doing in the district knowing that we have a B or knowing that we have a C? It doesn't help us. But when you get down to very specific questions about certain elementary programs or full-day, half-day kindergarten programs, or should we have, reading programs at various levels of the school. I think there it gives us some very useful information regarding the direction the district should be taking. But I just know, given the Gallup poll and other things, is that that's the question that will probably come out in the media the most. is, you know, what was the grade that was given to the school district.
Results of the survey are expected to be compiled early next year. Stayrook hopes to have all the surveying done before the Christmas holiday break. Then he can start to tabulate all the numbers. Demographic information about respondents will be broken down, but individual information about the people answering the survey will be confidential. Just what the district will do with all the information gathered will be up to the school board. Stayrook says there are a number of things that could happen.
One, there are some specific questions that we can compare to previous years so that we can see whether or not we have changed over time. The opinion of the community is getting better or worse with respect to certain areas of the schools. It gives us one measure of how well the school district is doing in terms of providing education to the students. And basically, we would like to get information from the community, and some of the questions are set up in such a way that'll help provide us information when we start doing our long-range planning to improve our school district. In other words, questions in here on full-day kindergarten, for example. Well, if we find that 90% of the people responding to the survey, which would be an outstanding, you know, outstandingly large percentage, if that many people wanted a full-day kindergarten program, then we are going to have to do a number of things to try to plan to put such a program in place.
Stayrook says, on the other hand, if finances become a problem in the future, the survey can also show what things the community sees as less important. That could play a role in determining where any budget cuts might have to be made. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
Hazelwood's attorneys are trying to make sure that Skipper never goes on trial. Their main challenge is based on immunity. Federal law and state regulations saying someone who reports an oil spill can't be prosecuted for that spill. Hazelwood called the Coast Guard on March 24th, saying he was fetched up hard aground on Bly Reef and leaking, and his lawyers say that's enough to shield him from prosecution. Superior Court Judge Carl Johnstone says he's leaning against granting Hazelwood the broadest kind of immunity available under the law. That neutralizes the defense argument that the mere act of reporting the spill is enough to protect Hazelwood. Now the legal dance is centered on a more subtle distinction. The defense is arguing that Hazelwood's statement that the tanker is leaking can't be used against him, and neither can anything else that derives from that statement, including much of the investigation undertaken by the state. That leaves the state's attorney, Bob Linton, trying to prove it was inevitable that the grounding and the spill would have been found and investigated.
Our position is that at some point, the consequences of a spill become so great that persons would have become aware of it, even if there had been a report. In fact, even if the master of a vessel had exercised his Fifth Amendment rights, which he shouldn't really have, and simply remained silent, that is, if the vessel had gone aground and Captain Hazelwood, in this case, not made any report at all, would this spill have been found and when?
Within 4 days of the spill, state attorneys realized that any future legal case could be covered by the immunity issue, exactly the kind of immunity now claimed by Hazelwood's lawyers. In an effort to insulate themselves from information that could have been tainted by Hazelwood's statements, Linton set up two parallel sets of investigations. One group would use all of the information available, including Hazelwood's statements. The second group of prosecutors would operate without the benefit of Hazelwood's remarks and investigations by the Coast Guard and other agencies. The idea was to prove that the state could have gotten all the information it now has, even without Hazelwood. But defense attorney Richard Freeman says it doesn't work that way.
And the point is this, that the entire investigation was completed, or virtually the entire investigation was completed, before they took any actions to protect Captain Hazelwood under this immunity claim. What that means is that they really are trying to unring the bell. All of this was put together before they even address the immunity issue. When they finally address the issue, they are trying to cut this off, get the benefits of everything, all his statements, everything that they were led to from his statements, without paying the price that in Congress and in our case in the state, the state regulatory agencies expected.
Freeman won't be calling witnesses to back up his case. Instead, he'll try to knock holes in the testimony offered by state witnesses. Captain Hazelwood won't be taking the stand either. The proceeding is expected to last 2 weeks. If defense attorneys fail in their effort to block the state charges, Hazelwood's trial will start January 22nd. In Anchorage, I'm Bruce Meltzer.
Three, two, one. Three public hearings about the proposed graduation requirement changes have been held over the past 2 months. After hearing the public's concerns, board members have finalized a proposal for consideration. The stricter requirements will come before the board next month. The school board will consider having students take one more credit before graduation, so they would have to take 22 credits instead of 21. The plan that's on the table also calls for students to take one more year of science and another year of math. The board will also consider making algebra a required high school course. And changing the physical education requirements has also been proposed by the board. Currently, 2 years of PE are needed to graduate. The board will consider changing that to 1 year of PE and 1 year of health education. Board President Jerry Macbeth, who has been a strong supporter of some change in the high school graduation requirements, says now that something has been finalized for review, the board expects to hear from the public again.
We wanted to identify some of the issues and further define them before we brought them to the board table for consideration. I think all members of the board are conscious that this is a change, even though it's a modest one, and we want there to be lots of opportunities for public input, so there would be two more opportunities. We have a meeting on December 19th. Where they would be introduced for the first reading, and then there would be a meeting in January for the second reading.
Another element that the board will explore is whether or not to require an entrance exam for incoming high school students. That would be used to see students' level of achievement and determine what areas they may need to devote more attention to during the high school years. School board members' discussion at a work session last night centered not just on the graduation requirements, but the overall quality of the education students are getting. Board members raised a number of points that have come up during the public hearings on the graduation requirements. They want to look at the need for better counseling at the high school level and the elective courses that are available to students. The board plans to review several of those concerns in the coming months. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
The rate increase is the first in 6 years for Pioneer Home residents. They'll be paying from $100 to $275 a month more for a bed and meals. That's actually less than what had been talked about as an increase. It should raise more than $400,000 a year in extra rent. Still, the increase won't come close to paying all the system's bills. The state now spends roughly $27 million a year on operating the Pioneer Homes. Only $3 million of that is raised through fees charged to residents. And when the rate increases take effect in January, the Cooper administration will be asking the legislature for another $1 million or more to pay extra costs in operating the system. Deputy Commissioner of Administration Jim Fox says that financial fact of Pioneer Home life is generally understood by residents.
I do think that a majority feel that some adjustment in the rates was warranted, and most of the discussion I had with residents through the hearing process related to what was reasonable.
Besides the rate increase, a few changes in rules for Pioneer Home residents will also take effect in January. Included is one change aimed at freeing up more nursing care bed space in the homes. Nursing care is now required for one of every two Pioneer Home residents, and Fox says that has put extra pressure on the homes that nobody intended when they were first built.
And as medical care improves and they live longer, they just kind of filled up. And now we're trying to accommodate some of those in the residential wings who are already in the need of some services, who are no longer capable of independent functioning.
To do that, the system is formalizing a rule of thumb that 30 days is the limit for acute care in Pioneer Homes. After that, the state will try to find hospital or private nursing home care for residents needing it. And that's a far more expensive proposition. With the rate increase, it will cost just $800 a month for nursing care in the Pioneer Homes. Some private homes in the state charge 10 times that amount. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.